In this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast, we talk with the author of Trailblazers, The Women of the Boeing Company. Also, inductees into the 2016 International Pioneer Hall of Fame, Chinese Airlines order Boeing, Aviation Week's Person of the Year, commercial flights to Cuba, Kuwait Airways drops a route, Amazon.com may start its own air freight operation, an online search for empty GA seats gets some bad news. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 382 of the show where we talk aviation. This episode, I'm joined by aviation historian David Vanderhoof.
Hey, Max. Well, it's the end of the year. We're recording this on the darkest night of the year.
That's right.
That means spring's coming and air show season, and 2015's almost gone, and I have to say I'm thankful for that.
Yeah, well, this is our last episode for this year for 2015. So we'll try to make it a good one. And to help us do that, of course, is Max Trescott, the other Max. He's a CFI, an author, a speaker, a glass cockpit expert. Max Trescott, how are you?
Hey, hello there, Max and David. I am awesome. And I just want to say that since it's the last show of the year, that means it's actually been a full year that I've been with the show. And I want to thank you both for inviting me.
It's
Yeah, I know. It started out about a year and a half ago when I was, pinch hitting for Rob when he was writing a book over the summer. And then just you guys invited me to stick around. And
yeah.
So it's been about a year and a half. And I've been having a fantastic time. And just want to let you know how much I really have enjoyed being a part of this and looking forward to 2016 as well.
And we've really enjoyed having you. And the expertise that you bring to the show has been just really wonderful.
And you know what? Part of it's the camaraderie. I really enjoy the emails and other phone calls during the week. It's just kind of fun to be part of the team, not just when we record, but all the time.
Oh yeah, there's a lot that goes on between all of us during the week.
Yep, and some of those jokes don't make it on the show, folks. But boy, do we have fun laughing at them.
Yes, yes. Well, we should mention that Rob Mark isn't able to join us. He's got another commitment.
We have to say this. Believe it or not, folks, Rob Mark blew off the show, the lecture about UAVs.
I know. Our resident dronophobe, right?
It's a Christmas miracle.
And Brian Coleman is off traveling, so he'll be off this episode as well. But we do have a fantastic guest. Our guest this episode is Betsy Case. Betsy's a writer, and she's the award-winning author of Trailblazers, The Women of the Boeing Company. Now, Betsy says the book acknowledges the inspiring women who helped make the company the success it is today. Betsy was a marketing writer at Boeing for 18 years, and she's the author of several Boeing store books, including In Plain View and The Jumbo Jet, Changing the World of Flight. She also authored Houseboat, Reflections of North America's Floating Homes, something that I'm definitely going to check out. And she's owned an advertising agency in Seattle. She's worked as a radio copywriter for several years. And Betsy was also a whitewater river guide. Betsy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here and talk about these incredible women in the book and share some stories with you guys.
And there are some really interesting stories, as well as just the overall message that the book brings is, I think, fascinating. Of all the things that you've done, including a whitewater river guide, was that the most exciting thing you've done in your history?
It was the most adrenaline-pumping thing that I've done. Yes, absolutely.
I can relate to that, having some experience many, many years ago with some whitewater canoeing back in my youth, I would say. We're going to talk with Betsy about the book and about some of the women that she captures in that book coming up. Just one sort of announcement. This is kind of a call to action, just really quickly. As Brian Coleman explained in a previous episode, he's trying to get to the Farnborough International Air Show in 2016 and bring us some really great coverage from the event. But he needs our help to cover some of the costs. Now, Brian has just set up a GoFundMe page where we can all make financial contributions. This is separate from the donation button that we have on airplanegeeks.com in that this is specific to getting Brian to Farnborough. So we set up an easy shortcut to Brian's GoFundMe page. It's just simply airplanegeeks.com/Farnborough2016. So please consider helping out. All right, with that, let's get started with some aviation news. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Absolutely.
Our first item comes from AOPA. This is military Betsy, how do we say this word? I know this word, but I always stumble over it.
Aviatrix?
Aviatrix, but the plural version.
What's the plural exactly?
Aviatrices? I believe that is, that's a really good question. I don't have it in front of me, so it's hard to visualize it.
Yeah, so the title of the article is Military Aviatrices Honored. Boy, this makes for great radio, doesn't it, Max T?
Absolutely.
All right, so what's the point of this? Well, Women in Aviation International, a group we've talked about in the past many times, they've announced their inductees into its 2016 International Pioneer Hall of Fame. And it is a really amazing group of women, including an entire class of undergraduate pilot training graduates from the Air Force. These were the first 10 female officers to graduate from the Air Force undergraduate pilot training program, and they completed their training along with 36 male officers. So, Betsy, what a great group! What a great accomplishment!
You know, it's really fun. I was at the 2015 Women in Aviation Convention in Dallas and was there when they inducted several Hall of Famers. And I have to tell you, just being at the convention was the most amazing experience. I was so awed by all of the fabulous young women, pilots especially, walking around in either their commercial airplane uniforms or their military uniforms. And they were so, first of all, some of the women in the book were there as well, and they kept saying they're so young, but they were just young and confident and just unbelievably impressive. And Women in Aviation is impressive as well. You guys probably know this, but yes, the audience might not. Last year alone, they gave away almost $600,000 in scholarships to young women who want to be in the aviation industry, whether it's pilots or mechanics or whatever. So it's an incredible organization.
Yeah, it really is. And if people are looking for an aviation organization to contribute or to donate to support, Women in Aviation International, WAI, is definitely on, I think, the list of those to consider.
I'd like to add my two cents. I went to one of their conferences in Southern California, I want to say 6-7 years ago. I was a member for a brief period of time. And of all the different conferences I've ever been to, I have never seen one that was more focused the attendees were more focused on learning what it takes to kind of get ahead in their career in aviation. They had a lot of different seminars, but the one that had the greatest attendance, you know, more than 100 people sitting there, and everyone in the audience was just, you know, rapt attention focused on the speaker, was on, you know, getting ahead, professionalism in the job. So, you know, anybody who really wants to get ahead in aviation, whether they're male or female, great conference to attend.
Absolutely.
You can tell they just all have this passion about flying, about aviation in general. And several of the women in the book, I think there's half a dozen of them, who are Hall of Famers for Women in Aviation. Mm. So they've already been inducted.
David, as our resident military aviation expert, what can you tell us about the Air Force undergraduate pilot training program?
Basically, what you're starting off to be a pilot. undergraduate means you learning the basics of flying. Then you move on to graduate flying, which would be after you pass your undergraduate, you move on to graduate flying. So you go into transports or fighters or helicopters. But basically, undergraduate is learning the basics. It's going out in a Cirrus and learning how to fly at the academy, or going out learning in a T-6 Texan 2, the basics. It's the same thing our two instructor pilots would teach the students. You know, how to do touch and goes, how to do rolls, how to do stalls. Then they move on to graduate, which is your next, which is your specialization, whether you go to fast jets or you go to transport. But undergraduate is just that. It's learning to fly, learning to be a military aviator.
And does this all take place at the Air Force Academy, or does this take place at multiple locations?
It takes place at multiple occasions. You don't need to go to the Air Force Academy to become an Air Force pilot. In fact, most of the people who go to the Air Force Academy don't become pilots. Only a small fraction of them actually become pilots. There are people who go to ROTC and then come out of college, then go to undergraduate flight school. There are some people who normally you need a degree. So there are various college programs which will people get engineering degrees, or and then they will go learn to be pilots as an undergraduate. So there's multiple tracks. You don't necessarily have to be a pilot in the United States Air Force. You do not. You have to be selected for officer school and pilot's training, but you don't have to actually go to the academy. Likewise for the Naval Service, you don't need to be a Marine Corps pilot or to be a Naval pilot. You do not necessarily have to go to the academy. You go through, go to school, get your undergraduate degree, and join a ROTC program, or enlist as an officer, go to officer candidate school, and then go through your training.
Okay. Well, back to the WAI, there are a couple of individuals who are going to be inducted. One is Brenda Robinson, who's got kind of an amazing background. One of 10 women selected in 1977 by the U.S. Navy to enter boot camp, followed by naval flight training. In 79, she was the 59th woman to enter naval flight training. 1980, she became the 42nd woman to earn her wings for the U.S. Navy's first African-American female pilot. She went on to become a flight instructor at NAS Pensacola, Navy's first Gulfstream 3 VIP transport pilot. She flew a DC-9 during Desert Shield and Desert Storm. And then if that's not enough, she had a 17-year career at American Airlines. She's retired now, founded a company, and launched the Aviation Camp for young people. So a really kind of an amazing individual.
But if you know one thing about her career, at the time, she was not allowed to fly fighter jets. That's why she was a flight instructor and then flew the C-9. And Desert Storm was the first point where women could actually fly into combat zones, but they could not actually fly combat. So she was flying a VR transport, which is... So her career, while milestone-breaking, she wasn't one of the ones to get into the later things, which was flying Hornets and Tomcats, etc. But,
and actually, one of the women in the book, Trish Beckman, was instrumental in getting that ban lifted and allowing women to fly in combat. Really amazing story.
Are there any restrictions at all in terms of women flying in combat now, or are those just removed and it's equal for men and women?
Well, it's equal for men and women. In fact, next year, the public affairs office for the Blue Angels will be a woman. The Thunderbirds have had woman pilots,
right,
as well as almost all combat squadrons now have female pilots, Navy and Air Force. The non-flying combat has been lifted. They're flying the same missions the men are.
And then the final inductee is General Janet Wolfenbarger. She was commander of Air Force Material Command at Wright-Patt Air Force Base in Ohio. That's a large organization, David. I think that's like 80,000 people.
It's the big one. And the Air Material Command is the command that keeps all of the other commands flying, keeping the supplies, the parts, doing testing. So RAPAD is a huge organization that probably touches all aspects of the Air Force, from the ground, from the people on the ground to the aircraft in the skies. So she had a very large command and a very well-respected command.
And then she was also in the F-22 system program office. She was the lead program element monitor for the F-22 at the Pentagon. She was a B-2 system program director. She commanded ASC's C-17 Systems Group, Mobility Systems Wing, Director of Air Force Acquisition Center of Excellence at the Pentagon, AFMC Vice Commander from December 2009 to September 2011. Just a really amazing, amazing career.
Absolutely, and one where she made herself well-known and some of the programs that she touched were really well run. So congratulations to her. And another aspect of, you don't have to necessarily fly to be in aviation.
Right. Yes. Well, the ceremony for this is going to take place in March 2016. This will be at the closing banquet of the 27th Annual International Women in Aviation Conference. That's at the Gaylord Opryland Resort and Convention Center in beautiful Nashville, Tennessee. It's a great convention to attend, and you don't have to be a woman.
That's right. There were a lot of men there.
All right. Very good. Let's see. If you want to find out more about the WAI, their website is wai.org. The conference website is wai.org/16conference. Betsy, there have been a number of other trailblazers who've been in the WAI Hall of Fame. Did we mention most of them already?
The ones out of the book, no. Actually, Trish Beckman, I already mentioned her. She was the one who was instrumental in lifting the ban on women in combat flights. Jackie Cochran, you guys have probably talked about Jackie Cochran. She was one of the founders of the WASP, and they called her the Speed Queen. Barbara Erickson, she's the woman on the cover. And, you know, the list of what Barbara accomplished is pretty impressive. She built B-17s. She actually was studying at the University of Washington and decided that she was studying home ec. And decided she'd rather fly than learn how to make a souffle. And it was during World War II, she went to work at Boeing as a Rosie, building B-17s. And then she joined the WASP and was a ferry pilot for B-17s. And was one of the few WASP who earned a medal at that particular time. She earned the Air Service Medal for flying. And I always find this so amazing, for flying, I believe it was 8,000 miles in 5 days.
In 5 days, right, yes.
In a B-17, and I have to, you know, people go, well, you know, it's in a B-17. It wasn't a jet, you know.
Right.
It didn't go very fast. So I just think, when did you sleep? That's what I always think about when I read that story. When did you sleep?
And Barbara was also very high up in the WASP organization. As I recall, she was one of the top commanders of the organization at one point.
Yeah, that's correct. And then Nell DeLee, she's also in the book. She's an amazing woman in her own right. She's also one of the founding board members, as is Trish Beckman. So there are several women in the book who are in the WAI Hall of Fame.
All right, let's move on to our next story. This is from investors.com. Boeing gets $10 billion order, but Delta buys used 777. This relates a little bit to something we talked about previously, but what we see here is that China Southern Airlines has said that it's going to buy 30 737 next generation airplanes and 50 737 MAX airplanes. And Xiamen Airlines, which is a unit of China Southern, is buying 30 737 MAX jets. China, of course, is a big growing market. We have the COMAC C919, which is sort of in the same class as the 737 coming along, but it's got a ways to go. it's a big order. It's a nice order for Boeing, and of course also for CFM International, which is the sole power plant on the 737 MAX. We've talked about that. That's the LEAP 1B engine. So the 737 MAX is rolling along pretty well.
There's an interesting article on the Motley Fool that talks a little bit about this, and they think that some of the orders this month have been conversions from NGs to MAX, and so that some of the sales that Boeing's announcing, may not actually be net increases in sales. So that's kind of an interesting sidebar. And of course, the stock price went down just about the time that was announced, but for an entirely different reason.
The entirely different reason being?
Ah, Delta. You remember the
that's right.
Delta chairman Richard Anderson was touting his great purchase of a used 777 for a little over $7 million. And I guess the stock market kind of freaked out a little bit that, Delta is buying used airplanes rather than buying, new ones at substantially higher prices.
Yeah, but Delta's got a tradition of that at this point. Didn't they buy all of the AirTran Boeing 717s? They bought them from AirTran or Southwest. So they like buying used airplanes. They'd rather buy used airplanes than spend money on new ones.
Yeah, and that was Anderson's history when he was CEO at Northwest. Apparently there they would take 40-year-old DC-9s and refurbish them with new cabins. So it's rather interesting, philosophy. It makes sense on one level, but, you also look at other airlines that are kind of going in the opposite direction and buying, new airframes simply because of the lower maintenance cost. And, I'm sure the customers would probably prefer to be on the newer airplanes.
Wait a minute. You actually think they actually care about customers?
No, you're right. Customers only care about price. They probably don't care about the age of the airframe.
Our two cynics aren't here, so I better take over the role.
Good job.
Well done, in my opinion.
Oh, David. Well, speaking of Delta, speaking of Richard Anderson, Aviation Week has announced that he's their Person of the Year for 2015. Aviation Week gives the award, in their words, to the person who, for better or worse, had the greatest impact on aviation or aerospace over the year. And again, they've awarded that to Anderson. They mention a number of reasons. They talk about the Delta Northwest merger, the fact that the airline is so profitable. They talk about the oil refinery that Delta bought. We've talked about that in the past. The degree to which Delta is making international investments in Brazil, the UK, Mexico, even in China. It's quite an award. I think any CEO has the joy of having some people who love him and some people who don't. And that's probably the case here as well. In our next story, this comes from the WTOP news affiliate. U.S.-Cuba aviation deal allows 110 scheduled flights a day. So Cuba is opening up a bit, somewhat slowly maybe, in terms of flights from the United States, commercial flights. And the State Department has been talking with Cuban officials, and they now say that U.S. airlines can negotiate with the Cuban government for up to 20 routes a day to Havana and 10 to each of 9 other airports in Cuba, which makes for a total of 110 round trips. I don't think this is going to happen immediately, but this really does open up a lot of opportunity for U.S. airlines.
The one thing that still has to change a little bit is the limitation on visas. I went and looked this up just about a week ago because, frankly, I want to go to Cuba. I think it would be fun to go. But these days, you still have to fall into one of maybe 10 or 12 different very narrowly defined categories. Right. As I looked at them, about the only one that I could possibly wedge my way into would be to be a journalist working on a story. But even then, they go on with a lot of detail as to, it's got to be a full-time journalist. It's got to be for a particular freelance story article that you're working on. You can't spend more free time while you're in Cuba than you would be if you had a normal, you know, 9-to-5 type job, which it's like, wait a minute, I'm going to spend 8 hours of my day doing journalism, then I can look around for the other, you know, 4 or 5 hours. So I think something's got to change there. But, you know, maybe the other issue is just infrastructure. There probably aren't enough hotels and things like that to accommodate the, you know, the huge horde of folks that would like to go visit. So I can see why opening things up slowly might make sense.
How many real airports do they have?
Well, at least 11, because...
But, I mean, okay, they've got 11 airports, but really? How many of them are suitable for
big commercial
domestic or commercial flights?
Yeah, that's the question, sure. I think that's part of the issue is the capacity of the airports to handle more tourists. The hotels, as you know, we were just saying... also, things like telecommunications, right? Can you just imagine hundreds and thousands of tourists arriving with their mobile phones expecting service? And, you know, is the country able to handle that volume? So there's really a lot of things that Cuba needs to, address. And I don't think this is a surprise to them. I think this might be part of why this has to happen sort of incrementally as the capacity is built.
And there was an article, I think it was an Air and Space magazine, and I want to say it was long ago as 1999, in which a journalist was allowed to go into the country and kind of look at the aviation, side of things there. So I'd recommend that for anybody who wants to, read a little bit about aviation in Cuba.
Good. We have an item from Yahoo.com. Kuwait Airlines accused of anti-Semitism with Israeli ban. This is kind of a complicated one, I think. I'm not sure where I end up on this one, but Kuwait Airways, they dropped their route from JFK to London Heathrow. And the story kind of goes back to 2013 when an Israeli citizen, Eldad Gat, complained to the U.S. Department of Transportation that he could not fly on the airline because the online booking system didn't give him the option to select Israel as the country issuing his passport. Now, Kuwait Airlines says that Kuwait law prohibits business with Israelis, so they cannot recognize Israeli passports. And some people are saying that this policy amounts to anti-Semitism. There's been a legal case, a dispute brought to the courts. The airline petitioned a federal appeals court to review this dispute, and at the same time, or I guess coincident with it, announced that they would cancel their JFK to Heathrow flight. So it's kind of a complicated situation. Anytime we get too deep into politics on this show, we get into trouble. But I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on this.
Yeah, it was interesting. The only other wrinkle on the story was that apparently one cannot travel to Kuwait. In other words, you can't arrive in the country on an Israeli passport. And this particular flight was the only flight that to Kuwait Airways runs that doesn't end up, in Kuwait. So presumably, someone who wasn't allowed to be in Kuwait could have been on this flight. And I guess... this was kind of the one corner case where they just decided, well, it's probably just easier to drop the flight than have to, change their business procedures to accommodate, the wishes of the right. United States and the wishes of their country.
I think this sort of thing has happened in other areas in this region as well. I mean, I can say that I know of people who travel to that region, to the Middle East, to Israel, to the surrounding countries fairly often. And a number of them will have multiple passports so that they use a passport for entry into a particular country, depending on where they've been previously. So they won't use some passports to entry into one country and use others for another country. So, this thing kind of does go on. I guess it's kind of unfortunate, but that's sort of the state of the world. Something kind of interesting, GeekWire reports that Amazon is starting to look at its own air cargo operation, and they want to use 20 Boeing freighter jets. There's been some buzz about this, about Amazon.com creating its own air freight operation. And we'll put some articles in the show notes, but in November, Motherboard published something called A Secretive Air Cargo Operation is Running in Ohio, and signs point to Amazon. The Seattle Times published Amazon in talks to lease Boeing jets to launch its own air cargo business. And now we see Cargo Facts reports in Amazon building its own overnight air freight operation that they're creating a logistics operation, they say, quote, that will include overnight air operations in the U.S. domestic market, potentially including the acquisition of at least 20 freighter aircraft. So, well, certainly Amazon ships a lot of boxes around. Well,
yeah, I read that 2 weeks ago they just bought literally thousands of truck trailers. So it looks like they may be looking to try and bypass some of their traditional suppliers. They had a massive meltdown back in 2013 when both the UPS and FedEx were unable to meet the demand that they had over the Christmas season. So one just has to wonder, is perhaps Amazon not trying to build up their own delivery network just to avoid those kind of problems, or maybe just to cut out the middleman and reduce their cost overall. Now, I saw that if you want to lease 20 767s, that's about $72 million a year. So clearly they're putting a lot of money on the table if they're really going to step up to create their own cargo system.
And Max, my bet is this will happen a hell of a lot quicker than Amazon Prime Air.
Oh, yeah, the drones? Yeah, I agree.
So you think it's easier to get 20 freighter aircraft up in the sky and running your own air freight business than to get some little quadcopters or multicopters delivering packages?
Absolutely.
What's really impressive is just what's breaking news as we're recording this. If you want to talk about cargo and returning, SpaceX successfully returned home and landed successfully after deploying two satellites in space. Oh. Stage one landed. So after a trial and error, they actually had a successful flight. So reusable to Earth to orbit rocketry just made a major milestone.
And if you want to look at other breaking news, by the way, today is the first day as we're recording this that the FAA's UAV registration website is available, and it crashed.
Is that because of the number of people who accessed it? Maybe.
It's probably just because that's what people are going to be doing with their drones anyway, kind of crashing them.
Well, either that or it was designed by the same people who did the affordable healthcare website.
Well, let's see. It would be a government website, wouldn't it? Hmm.
All right. A couple more items really quick. This is from Motherboard also. FAA grounds Uber for planes. Now, this is about the startup company FlightNow that in 2014 created a platform where people looking for a flight could look online for private pilots who were offering a seat. Now, in court, the FAA argued that this scheme violates the Federal Aviation Act of 1958 and other FAA regulations because pilots who are compensated for their services must hold a commercial license. Max T, this must be a concept that you're very familiar with.
Oh, definitely. It's something that all pilots are taught. And it was kind of an interesting gray area. Pilots have always been able to share expenses with other pilots if they're traveling, more or less in the same direction. And so in the past, it's been commonly accepted practice that a private pilot could put up a note on a note board, and we're talking physical cork boards now here, which says, hey, looking for someone to share expenses on my flight to Bakersfield on next Tuesday. What the FAA has held and what the courts have now agreed is that that's fine if you're just going to be doing it locally on a little cork board, but it's not acceptable if you're broadcasting it widely on a website to many people. And so they weren't the only company doing that. There was a company called Airpooler here on the West Coast, which in the spring of 2014 had been setting up something like that at one of the flight clubs that I teach at in Palo Alto. And when that first happened, I contacted one of my FAA friends at headquarters who said basically, yeah, everybody here thinks this is not legal. So it's been pretty clear for quite a while that if you look at the way the FAA has traditionally described what's legal and what's not, that this was pretty cut and dry that really didn't look legal. And the reason is that when you go to a website, you're really advertising, you're holding out to the public that you're a carrier. And, the public just doesn't know what the quality is of, some random private pilot who said, hey, I'll take you for a ride. And the FAA feels that the safety of the public deserves a little bit more protection than that.
One of the arguments that FlightNow made is that what's the difference really between a cork board in a local FBO and a web page that's online? It's just kind of scope, isn't it? But the appeals court didn't buy that argument and sided with the FAA on this.
Yeah, it definitely is scope. So, yeah, admittedly, the line is a little gray in that regard.
This is an interesting item coming to LAX, 13 comfort dogs for frazzled flyers. Who found this article?
I found it. I just thought it was cute.
It is cute.
I think it's a great idea.
So there's some interesting examples of how animals are employed, if you will, by airports. Sometimes, dogs for stressed flyers. There's some other examples. Do you guys have some favorites from this article?
Well, I think that United Airlines had their United Paws program, and it's really just kind of cute. The whole idea is that research shows that time spent with a dog can reduce blood pressure and reduce stress. And so since the holidays are kind of a frazzled time to be flying, they're going to bring, 13 dogs into LAX to have them in the United terminal to help de-stress travelers, which is great. I'm sure some of the travelers would like to take the dog and, take them on the airplane with them.
Yeah. Well, there's some other examples, things like airports using goats I guess you could call it vegetation management. There were trial programs at Portland International Airport and at Chicago where they've been using goats for lawn maintenance. I thought that was a pretty interesting one. Of course, I think we've talked about the use of falcons to scare away birds. Bird strikes, of course, it can be a big issue. In wildlife management at airports is always a kind of a problem, but there's a company, Falcon Environmental Services, that uses falcons to, scare the birds away from airports. And then how about the mice? The Israeli security firm that's developing, it says here, an explosive detection system manned by mice. So I guess, how do you think this works? You deploy the mice out and they somehow let you know if they sniff bombs?
Boy, it seems like there'd be a very obvious counter strategy, right? Whenever you place a bomb, just include some rat poison in the bomb.
Oh, I thought you were going to say cats.
I thought he was going to say cheese.
I was going to say, who moved my cheese?
Yeah. Oh, dear. All right. Again, we're speaking with Betsy Case. Betsy, again, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thank you.
So one of the things we want to talk about is this book about the trailblazers at Boeing. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about what it was that kind of caused this idea to come together and gel into a book?
Well, it started with a question. I had been a marketing writer at Boeing for quite some years and had done a lot of work for the branding and advertising organizations at corporate in Chicago and had done some historical research and writing for them, particularly about the Rosies. And two executives in the advertising and marketing departments put on an event for some executive women from across Chicago just to tell them a little bit about Boeing and what was going on and some history. And part of that presentation was some information I had written about the Rosies. At the end of the presentation, the woman who was then vice president of diversity at Boeing stood up and said, "Have you ever thought about doing a book about the Rosies?" And the executive who was making the presentation said, and what I thought was a moment of sheer enlightenment, "Well, really, the bigger picture is a book about all of the women who've contributed to Boeing over the last nearly 100 years." everybody thought that was a great idea. As the two executives were walking out, and I knew both of these men very well, had done lots of work, many hours of work for them, they looked at one another, they told me later, and said, Betsy has a project. So I got a phone call later that afternoon, and they said, Bets, what do you think? A book about the women of Boeing. And I said, I think it's about damn time. I mean, it's been 100 years. You know, there are lots of books about Bill Boeing and, you know, McDonald and all those guys, but nothing about the women. So I thought it was a superb idea. So that's how it all started.
When we talk about Rosies, of course, we're talking about the
Rosie the Riveter.
Right, exactly. In the huge numbers of women that were, I guess, critical, instrumental. There's a lot of words to describe it in the war effort, because while the men generally were off in combat, someone had to build those airplanes and all the other equipment required to support a war like that. And a lot of that was done by women.
Exactly. There's actually there's a monument to the Rosies, and they weren't just building airplanes; they were building all sorts of things. There's a monument down in Southern California. You guys may even have seen it. But to paraphrase it, part of the inscription is, "Without them, there would have been no spring in 1945."
Yes.
In other words, they were just as important to the war effort as the guys, you know, and the tanks and the airplanes, and you know.
Yeah, my grandmother built machine guns.
Oh, that's fabulous. That's fabulous.
My grandmother.
They were an amazing group of women, you know, and I was actually able to talk to a couple of them who are still around. They're in their 90s now. And they're magnificent women. I mean, you can just still see the fire and the passion and imagine what they were like, you know, in the early 40s, hopping on a train from New Orleans and going all the way across the country, totally not knowing where they were going, whether they had a job, whether they had a place to stay. But, you know, there was the adventure of the thing as well as, you know, their patriotic duty.
Thing that struck me as rather ironic when reading the book, it says that the very first woman hired in 1916 by Boeing was named Rosie. Now, is that a total coincidence?
It's a total coincidence. Okay. And people have picked up on that. There have actually been articles over the years called The Two Rosies. So, but yeah, her name was Rosie Farrar. She was known as a very fine seamstress in the Seattle area, and Bill Boeing hired her the first year of the new company to come and stitch the wings, the heavy canvas wings, on the Boeing B&W.
Yeah, and a great picture there too of the of a number of women working on those wings. I mean, that shows you that that was fairly tedious kind of work, I would imagine. So, does anyone really know what the origin of the name Rosie is for the World War II workers?
You know, I really don't. I know that there's a poster out that I believe I've heard over the years that it came from some sort of advertising, or maybe there was really a Rosie. Do you guys know?
I don't know. David, do you know?
I'm dodging this bullet and I'm not on mute. So I know.
All right, well we'll find out.
I think it was just an alliterative, how's that for a big word for the night? Alliterative slogan. You know, it's kind of like G.I. Joe. It was Rosie the Riveter. So I think that's how it came out in the marketing, and that would be my best guess, but don't hold me to it.
I like that. That makes sense.
Yes, I believe it was all part of the marketing, the advertising campaign. I mean, I think we've all seen that wonderful old poster with the woman with the bandana kind of holding her arm up.
Yes.
All about the advertising.
Yes, yes. Well, in the early days at Boeing, when a lot of aircraft were covered with fabric and so forth. I mean, that's where you you develop a need for people who are seamstresses or have those kinds of skills. But in reading the book, one of the things that struck me was that it seemed like Boeing embraced these women, not just because they had those kinds of skills. Do you get that sense?
I did. When I first started researching the book, I did get that sense that, you know, that women were considered just part of the team. And for a long time, it was not a very big team. It was like 26 people. But, you know, they hired more than seamstresses. In 1917, they hired a young woman named Helen Holcomb, and she was a draftsman at Boeing. And she, there's actually a copy of a letter that was sent to her. She had clearly, based on this letter from Boeing, sent in a request to be, you know, to be hired at Boeing to be a draftsman. And they responded by saying, send us some of your work. And they hired her in 1917. There's actually one of my favorite pictures in the book is a picture of Helen Holcomb. She's sitting in the Red Barn. For all of those who know the Museum of Flight in Seattle, the Red Barn is still there. And she's sitting in the Red Barn. There's a sea of drafting tables. They're all, you know, men. She's the only woman, so there are all these men working around her. And the only difference in her drafting table and all the other ones is that she's got a big bowl of flowers sitting on her drafting table. And it's kind of like, you know, I'm good at what I do. I'm just as good as the boys, but I'm still a girl. You know, I still like my flowers. So it's a great picture. One of the first I found, actually, when I started researching the book, I was just delighted. It was kind of like a beacon. Yes, there is information for this book.
Well, another one of the things I like about this book is just how the material is presented. And it's, of course, a combination of photographs. You know, many are really impressive historical photographs of the woman or of the women in their environment at Boeing, along with, I don't know, would you call that a vignette of that particular individual and maybe how they came to Boeing, what kind of career progression they went through, what they accomplished and things like that. It's just this blend of text and photographs that I know for me, it kind of sweeps me through the history of Boeing and of all of these women. I think it's very effective.
Thank you.
Did you have trouble finding the photographs to do the illustration?
The research, everyone I found, I the whole time I was researching, it was like being on a treasure hunt. I don't know if you guys are aware, you probably are. There's a huge Boeing archive in Bellevue. And when I got the go-ahead from corporate, they basically gave me a budget to just do the research because none of us knew if there was even enough information to fill a book. And they gave me a budget and a couple of months and said, you know, go out and see what you can find. And I went over to the archives and started going through files. And, I mean, every time I came across a story or even a part of a story, in some instances, there were just torn copies of Boeing News Now articles. And then I would have to take a name or a piece of information and ferret it out, see if I couldn't go somewhere else to find the whole story. In other instances, the whole story was just right there. And, you know, those were the fun times. A lot of times I got enough information to be able to contact the woman if she was still alive. And then I went to live interviews. But every single woman in this book was just like finding gold. Every time I came across a story, it was like, hallelujah, here's another one.
And there are even a few mentioned at the end of the book where you really weren't able to learn the whole story.
That's correct. And those were very typical of the copies of copies that I found. I'd find like just a little torn piece of information. And then I'd start searching. For example, Bessie Marie Dempsey, who was the first female engineer at Boeing in Seattle, she started out actually as a vaudeville dancer named Yvonne St. Clair. And I found a copy of her obituary, and it was torn in half, so I didn't even have the whole story. I eventually tracked her to the Museum of History and Industry in Seattle, and they had a small file, and so I got the background on her. But it just was like pulling threads, you know, trying to get down to the basic pieces of things. And a few of them, the thread just didn't go anywhere. And so I thought, well, you know, I think these women deserve to be in the book. And up until several months, just a few months before the book was published, Barbara Jean Erickson was in that folder. Mm. And as I was finishing up the book and kind of polishing everything, I pulled that folder out and I thought, you know, they've got to be in the book. Somehow they've got to be in the book. And I started writing that one page called Lost in History. and thought, I'm going to Google everybody one more time. And that's how I found Barbara. And which was just, and talk about, I mean, I did a lot of work from home. And when I found her and was able to connect to her family and got the amazing photographs that I got of her from her daughter, I was literally dancing around my living room. I mean, you know, like a crazy woman. I was so excited. And that's how she wound up on the cover. I think I told you that the graphic designer and I were not agreeing on what was going to go on the cover of this book. He wanted to put a Rosie on. And I said, yeah, but Rosie's built more than airplanes. This is a book about Boeing. There needs to be an aviator on the cover of this book. And when Barbara's family sent me the photographs, they emailed me the photographs, and I opened that one and I said, hallelujah, here it is. This is our cover girl. But the other women, I found nothing on the other three. And as I've done presentations over the last year and a half, I always ask people, do you have any information about these women? I've gotten little tiny pieces of information, but nothing that can really lead me to a story.
Well, one of the effects that section had, the Lost in History section had on me, was it kind of pointed out that, you know, the value of keeping history, the value of having records, the value of not losing the information, because these are people. I mean, you go through this, you know, the whole book, and you're reading about all these amazing women who did all these amazing things. And then at the end, in the, you know, that last Lost in History section, you know, these are powerful women who also did amazing things, but we don't know that much. You know, it's lost. And how sad it's that is, you know?
Tragic. Yeah. Absolutely tragic. And there's so many more. I mean, as I make presentations, I have women come up to me and say, you know, my grandmother was a Rosie and did thus and so. Or I had a friend who was the first to do this at Boeing. So there's so many more stories out there. And that was, you know, part of the criteria for the book was that they had to be first at something. So I've heard more and more over the last year and a half about women who could very easily be in this book.
Yeah, and I hope more information about the lost trailblazers, as it were, surfaces over time. I bet it will. I wouldn't be surprised. Were there any other individuals that sort of stick out in your mind when you think about the research that you had done?
Well, one of my favorite women in the book is a woman named Nelda Lee. And I actually found her through another trailblazer. At a point about halfway through writing the book, I was pretty sure it was actually going to be a book, that there was enough information. And so the women that I had interviewed up until that point became recipients of little notes from me. Do you know of anybody else? Do you know this person? So someone led me to Nelda Lee, and she's actually become a good friend. She's a wonderful woman. She was the first flight test engineer at McDonnell Douglas, and she was the second woman to graduate with an engineering degree from Auburn University. And when she graduated, she hopped in her little VW bug and went up to St. Louis and just set herself up. She tells a great story about running into old Mr. McDonnell in the hallway, and he was there with a bunch of his cronies walking down the hall, and Nelda was standing, clearly the only woman in the place, with a group of other male engineers, and Mr. McDonald looked over and said, oh, see, we even have a woman draftsman. Well, Nelda didn't take kindly to that, she tracked him down in the cafeteria, and she walked up to him, and she said, Mr. McDonald, my name is Nelda Lee, and I have a degree in engineering from Auburn University. And he said, so you're an engineer, Miss Lee? And she said, yes, sir, I am. And she said, every time he saw her after that, he stopped and always made a point of saying, good morning, Miss Lee. How are you doing this morning? So, but Nelda was also the first woman to officially fly an F-15. She decided when she was in college that she would be a better engineer if she learned how to fly. So she took some elective courses and learned how to fly. And she confided in me that she actually also used to bake brownies and cookies and take them down to the airport and bribe some of the guys to take her up for some lessons. It worked pretty well.
Hey, whatever works.
But, absolutely. But, you know, one of my favorite stories goes back to the Women in Aviation Convention. Nelda and I were sitting down to a late dinner at the convention in a dark restaurant in the hotel. And we sat next to these four young women, clearly military pilots. And we were kind of chit-chatting, and Nelda leaned over to the woman closest to her and said, "Excuse me, is that an F-18 patch on your shoulder?" And the young woman said, "Yes, ma'am, I fly F-18s. And Nelda said, "Oh, you know, I worked on F-18s when I was at McDonnell Douglas, and I worked on F-15s, and they're just chit-chatting about the airplanes. And I'm waiting for her to say, oh, and by the way, I was the first woman to fly one." And she never did, and I finally just couldn't stand it any longer. And I sort of leaned into the conversation and said, "Excuse me, but what she's not telling you is that she was the first woman to fly an F-15. Well, it was just death of conversation at the table. And, you know, the other three young women turned around and looked at Nelda practically with tears in their eyes and just made comments along the lines of, "Without you, we would not be here."
There's a quote from Nelda Lee in the book. She says, "It doesn't require strength or endurance to do a job like this. It requires education and thinking skills and the ability to connect with others. A woman can do this. Your daughters, too, can do this."
Isn't that great? A lot of the women in the book who are still alive that I've worked with since the book was published are very passionate about, you know, sharing the joy and the excitement of math and science and engineering and technology with young girls. I mean, that's a real passion of theirs, and I so appreciate that.
Hmm. Just had to laugh, Betsy, at your story. I think that's just totally apropos, because what I've noticed is whenever I run into incredibly accomplished women pilots, they are not the ones that tell others what they've accomplished, which cannot be said usually about some of the men pilots.
Love that. That is a wonderful observation. I couldn't agree more. When I'm with these women, I have to say, "Oh, and did you know she did this?"
Exactly.
You know, if you're in a group of people, it's like I have to kind of, you know, what did my grandmother say? Don't hide your light under a bucket or a basket. So I'm always lifting the basket. So see what she did?
Indeed. Yeah. You know, one of the photos I absolutely love in here says that, below it, it says Rosie's made up 50% of the workforce at Douglas Long Beach facility during the peak of World War II, when 108 planes per week rolled off the line. You know, first off, I didn't realize that they were that high a percentage of the aviation manufacturing workforce. But second, the picture of these six ladies sitting on top of, I can't even tell what parts of an airplane, you know, these are, you know, working away on them is just, it's just a great photo.
You know, it's a great photo, but the story behind that photo is it's a marketing photo.
Oh, and I kind of guessed that just by the bright smiles, and you know, everybody has the wrench in the same position.
The real clue is they don't have their bandanas on.
Ah.
Their hair is flowing. And of course, they were not allowed to have their hair flowing in the factory because it could get caught in all manner of things.
Got it.
So they had to all wear, you know, their hair tied up when they were in the factory.
That's one of the reasons to watch Swing Shift with Goldie Hawn, and because Swing Shift, she's actually working the line at the Douglas plant, and the way they all the women dress to go for to do their jobs, it's really kind of cool. And then they in the evening they, you know, put a little bit of lipstick on to go to work, but they were getting all smudge faced, and then they go off, come home, and become a completely different person. So while it's not really a good movie for historical perspective, it is kind of interesting.
One of my favorites from the book is Eleanor Otto. Because,
yes.
Absolutely, mine too.
Is that right? Well, she...
Yeah, go ahead.
She joined, let's see, she started at, where did she start? It was about 70 years ago she started as a riveter. Roar Aircraft, was it? In California. And she was a particularly speedy riveter. But after the war, when many of these Rosies, probably almost all of them, I would imagine, were laid off, and she fell into some other jobs, but they weren't very interesting to her. She hated sitting around in an office. So in the 1950s, she had an opportunity to return, and she's worked at Douglas Aircraft. She's riveting wing sections on the C-17, and she's been an employee for 70 years now? That's amazing.
And then Diana Ray, also in the executive section. Diana Ray, I believe the last anniversary she celebrated with Boeing was her 72nd consecutive year.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And when we had the celebration at the Future of Flight, Diana was still working at Boeing on the 737 program. I don't know if she's still there or not. I believe she was a year ago. She was still working.
Wow. Wow.
This is incredible because it says Eleanor is 94 and she's still revving wing sections of the C-17 Globemaster.
I mean, isn't that incredible? I mean, I could see being in an office at 94. I could kind of see that, maybe sort of.
Yes.
But, you know, being in the factory riveting, that's a hard job when you're 20.
It's just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, all the women that I've met who've been in their 90s, like I said, are just, they're incredible. I mean, they're strong and they're with it and they're feisty and they're just more inspiring than I can say. It's like, I want to be like that when I grow up.
Yes. Betsy, tell our listeners where they can find a copy of Trailblazers, The Women of the Boeing Company.
Two places. Amazon, of course. Everything's on Amazon. If you go to Amazon.com, be sure you type in the entire name of the book, Trailblazers, The Women of the Boeing Company, or you can go to BoeingStore.com. Do the same thing.
And we'll put links to both of those in the show notes. So visit airplanegeeks.com/382, and you'll be able to click straight to both Amazon and the Boeing store. Just quickly, Betsy, you've written a couple of other books. Maybe you could mention those.
Two for Boeing. One is called In Plain View, and it's a book about the Everett factory. I don't know if you know. Of course you do. They do a lot of tours of the Everett factory from the Future Flight, and the book was really almost written as a companion piece to the tours. It talks a little bit about the history of the building, you know, the largest building by volume in the world still. You know, the building of the 747 and the Incredibles, and then a little bit about the 777 and the 67 and the new 787. So a little bit about all of that and the factory. For the 747 book, I was able to get some background information. And it talks about the 747 more in depth than the In Plain View book.
And Betsy, I just want to go ahead and mention that I'm looking at a picture right now of Barbara Erickson, whose married name was London. We have her in the brochure that we use for the Aero Club in Northern California, because she was at a luncheon we held about 5 years ago, and we had hosted five WAFs at the luncheon, and Barbara was there, and I got a chance to meet her. Her daughter lives here in Silicon Valley and was one of the very first female airline pilots in the United States. And it was a real pleasure to get a chance to meet Barbara. And, of course, we're happy to have featured her in our brochure.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm really jealous because I would love to have met Barbara. But I worked with her daughter, Terry, who was so helpful and so incredible and so supportive. And when we had the book kickoff at the Future of Flight, Terry actually came to that. So I was able to meet her as well. So I was thrilled that she was there.
By the way, Terry sent me an email this morning. She said that she was there and that she absolutely loved it. She had a great time at that event.
Oh, cool. That's cool. It was just a joy to meet her.
All right. Well, Betsy Case, we want to thank you again for coming on the show. I think that this book is, it's inspirational. I think that certainly as someone who's maybe shy about being a woman in an industry that is kind of male-dominated, I think it would just draw a lot of inspiration from this book. There's nothing that these women couldn't do. And I think the message of it in large part is that there's nothing that you can't do either, you know, if you put yourself to it, if you put your mind to it and try.
You know, in the book, there were a lot of stories that we started referring to the graphic designer and I started referring to as don't take no for an answer stories.
Yes.
So there's so many instances in this book of women who just wouldn't take no for an answer. What do you mean I can't be a pilot? What do you mean I can't fly an F-15? So I love those stories. I think they're the highlights of the book.
Perfect. Thanks again, Betsy.
You're welcome. I loved it. Thank you.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, with the airplane of the week.
Thanks, Max. I can't say that I'm sorry to see 2015 go. As we record this on the longest night of the year here on the north side of the planet, I'm faced with the knowledge that I have to do my yearly Christmas history segment. From carols to Christmas cirruses to tankers, it seems I've done a lot of different things for this segment, and it always seems to be the hardest one to write of the year. I know there's a clamor for me to write an English electric lightning segment, and that might come in a new year, but for tonight, it was a snowy night, the hangar was old, and the corrugation banged in the wind. The field was IFR and should have been closed. My ride was nestled in her bed. It was just me, and I should get to my hotel. The tower beacon scanned through the night like a lighthouse that no one could see. Its red, white, and green flashes seemed appropriate, though. There was one more flight due in, though it seemed impossible to make in this blizzard. I went for some coffee in the terminal. I really didn't have anywhere to go, but for an old friend, I'll wait. Better to swap war stories at a hotel bar tonight than be alone. Christmas Eve for a pilot away from home is a lonely night. So I threw open the door and stepped out into the cold, wondering if that caravan would make it tonight, and my friend, who was flying it, would make it home. Joe had been flying that milk run for what seemed forever. He could fly it blindfolded. Well, tonight it was like flying blind, only snow blind, that is. I made it over to the terminal and went to the pilot's lounge. Someone had left the coffee pot on. The coffee was warm, but you could eat it with a spoon. Next to the coffee were some cheese and beef stick. Guess a box from Hickory Farms fell out of the plane and ended here in this room. Then there were cookies. Mary always made cookies this time of year. I grabbed some cookies in the mud and made my way over to the couch with its vinyl cover still intact. That couch had to have been from the 70s. The thought crossed my mind that if ever there was a war, hiding under a vinyl seat cover would save you. Well, besides their cookies and their red and green buttery goodness, the only indication of this night was a string of lights hanging over the desk in the corner. I tried to think if they'd been up all year and someone had just turned them on. Nah, can't be. I would have noticed that many bulbs being out. I turned the radio on. It seemed to fit the mood better than playing carols from my iPhone. Run, Run, Rudolph came on, screaming like a saber jet. I never can forgive Buffett for changing the lyrics to Citation Jet. Well, I brought up the tracker app. Jesus, that donkey is flying in this stuff. Not a star in sight. What on earth could be so damn important? He was a half hour out. I wonder if the tower knew. I ran down the terminal to the cab, banged on the door. No answer. There was no one there. Great. I threw my bomber jacket back on and stepped outside. More wind, more snow, and, well, at least the runway was still lit, and it had more bulbs on it than the string in the briefing room. Oh, well, that's not so bad. I checked the phone again. He's 10 minutes out. Here I am stuck at an airport with Mary's cookies and Joe flying in a caravan. My G4 wool collar and silk scarf weren't keeping out the night. How the hell did those bomber crews do it in this thing? Bounced around my brain. I reached into my pocket, pulled out another cookie. It was a reindeer with a cherry for a nose. I'm partial to trees. They taste better. I don't like snowmen or Santas or reindeers. There's that whole do you bite the head off first issue. I don't have a problem with snowflakes or trees. That's why I think trees taste better. Where is that SOB? He's late. Rudolph went down in two bites. Damn, it's cold. Right now I could use an eggnog. You know, the one you pour over a full glass of scotch and then forget the eggnog part. I had another cookie. I stress each, don't judge. Besides, Christmas cookies come but once a year. So this is when the story gets weird. Again, I stare out at the night, trying to see the landing lights. As I was watching slowly, the snow started to stop. The wind started to calm over the field. The wind started to fall. I suddenly felt trapped in a reverse shaky thing. You know, you shake it and the dumb little snowman suddenly is in a blizzard. Or even worse, it's like a beach in Florida. Oh, yeah, a snow globe. Here I was standing in the middle of a snow globe that looked like the world outside was a blizzard, but inside was clear. I wondered to myself, no, silly, those weren't brownies, they're cookies, and no, the coffee doesn't make you hallucinate. I reached in the pocket for another one of those perfect little delights of butter, flour, sugar, and egg. Good, a tree. Then I suddenly paused. Off in the distance, I heard bells, sleigh bells. I look out over the field, and here comes that red spinnered caravan. Red and green lights blinking away. Joe leveled the wings, dropped the flaps, and made a perfect three-point landing. The prop blowing in the snow as he taxied toward the terminal. I ran out and chocked the wheels. As Joe was shutting down, I ran around tying the bird down. I never noticed its registration before. November 0 Echo 11 Echo. Suddenly, it was like someone decided to shake that shaky thing, and that cold snow was back, and so was that night wind. And the windsock started whipping around like the tail of a kite. Joe greeted my hand with a handshake and a Merry Christmas. My first response was, are you nuts? I mean, seriously, your chestnuts roasting on an open fire, nuts. Joe just grinned ear to ear beneath that white beard of his, now covered with snow. I had to get here. The cargo was too important, he shouted over the wind. He opened the belly hold, and there was a hold full of brown paper packages tied up with string. I need to get these presents to a very special place. We piled them in his red 4x4, and away we went. After 20 minutes of driving, or should I say sliding, we pulled up next to an old school on Crest Street. The lights were on, and there seemed to be a party. Before I could say, what the Christmas fudge, Joe had suddenly had a red suit. Yes, that one. I suddenly felt underdressed. We grabbed the presents and went in. Santa had arrived. It seems old Joe had been doing this for years. Since he was a pilot, he knew what it was like to be away from home on the holidays and how hard it was on the families. These were all families who had loved ones serving overseas. The USO would give Joe the dough, and he would get the presents and bring them here as Santa. Oh, and I'll be dancer. There was Mary handing out cookies and milk to the kids. Joe came back over to me, handed me a wrapped present, said, this will help you remember you're never alone on Christmas. I unwrapped the small box, and inside was a shaky thing. I mean snow globe. With a tiny little man watching a red-nosed caravan taxi up to him at an airport. I gave it a shake, and it started to snow. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Thank you all for listening. My wish for you in 2016 is may all your AV dreams come true. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks Historian, signing off for 2015.
Wow.
Bravo.
Yeah, David, best Christmas message yet, I think. Very nice. Very nicely done. All right. We have an Australia desk from Steve and Grant. Here's the guys.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, December 19th, 2015.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for the final episode of the year, episode 382. Well, at least that's what Max tells me. I'm pretty sure it's the last one of the year. And, Grant, what a hot day it is here in Melbourne. I wonder how cold it is up there in the US at the moment.
Oh, it's been all over the place, apparently, for them. But for us, it's about 40 degrees Celsius. So what is that? Going for 41. So I don't care what system you're using. Freaking hot works pretty well. And Christmas Day looks like it's going to be about 33 Celsius, so
lovely.
Reasonably warm.
Lovely summer Christmas weather anyway. Well, Grant, let's talk about something Qantas is doing for the first time in many, many years. In fact, as of yesterday as we record this, they've started operating back to San Francisco. And in fact, one of our good friends, Richard Muirden, one of our loyal listeners, was actually on the flight, probably flying first class like he always does.
No, actually, I believe this time he was flying in business. He was he's going over there to see some friends and I believe for a wedding. But yeah, he was posting on Facebook about it. And so we got to see his side of things. And he happened to be there when Qantas were doing their media fanfare for the arrival, did a bit of a media circus. And so he tagged along for that and also got the famous photo of, oh no, it's the Qantas kangaroo bouncing around the place.
And of course, that coincided with less than 24 hours later with the arrival into Sydney of an American Airlines, a Boeing 777-300ER. And that's the first time since the early 1990s that American Airlines have operated over here to Australia, and that's all part of a partnership agreement between those two airlines. So, yeah, good things happening.
Indeed, mate, indeed. And it's great to see that Qantas are returning there. They're making use of their 747s because now they're putting the A380 onto the Sydney-Dallas route. So, yeah, that's freed up a couple of 747s to allow them to do the Sydney-San Francisco once again.
Now, of course, it's interesting because as we've been saying for many, many years, we've been covering the slow demise of the Qantas 747 fleet. There's only about 11 of them, I think, 10 or 11 of them, I think, still flying now. So they've actually got more sitting across there in the desert in the US, just gathering dust now. So I guess it'll only be a matter of time before, if they're going to maintain this San Francisco route again. And, you know, frankly, let's hope they do, because flying into San Francisco is far more pleasant than coming to Los Angeles for an international traveler, I can tell you that much. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how long they keep 747s operating on there, or even how long they'll be able to if they keep retiring them at the rate they're doing.
Well, they've kept the long-range ones, the ERs, so we'll see how it goes, mate. But meanwhile, another area of aviation that's doing reasonably well in Australia is, of course, the dreaded remotely piloted aircraft systems, which is the drones.
Yes, drones now, of course, you know, increasingly popular over the last couple of years, but, you know, I think Santa is going to be delivering a lot of them this year for people who've been good, aviation freaks who are looking for, you know, perhaps a remotely piloted aircraft. And CASA has decided to step in here and just offer some guidelines. Rather than going down the route of, you know, regulating them to death, they're basically trying to, you know, be nice about it at the moment. And in fact, they've actually set up quite a good website at casa.gov/RPA, remotely piloted aircraft. And we'll put a link in the show notes to that. And they've actually put out a YouTube video where they're just giving some guidelines on to how to fly these aircraft safely and to how to keep them the heck away from other aircraft, like real aircraft.
And other people as well. So rather than going down the registration path that the US have used, they've preferred to go down more of an education. They do have laws. They, you know, you can't fly them above 400 feet, can't fly them within about 3 to 5 miles, I believe it is, of an airport. Can't use them for commercial acts. You need to actually have commercial use permission, which we have quite a number of groups, as we've reported recently, doing so. And you're not allowed to fly it within within 30 meters of people, or above crowds, things like that. You can't fly them near helipads. So, yeah, it's they're trying to highlight all that, and they've gone down the education path and awareness, and we'll see how it works with Christmas just around the corner.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I'm reading an article here, Grant, that is in the australian.com.au. It actually says here that the Civil Aviation Safety Authority has only issued 15 financial penalties in the last financial year to people who've breached guidelines that prohibit the devices being flown, for example, above 120 metres. And as you mentioned there, Grant, within 30 metres of people or near other aircraft. Now, we've had some incidents in recent years where people have tried to get, you know, really good photo shots with these aircraft, but flying them too close to, particularly to, you know, passenger jets and all that sort of stuff as they're on approach to major airports. But the fact that they've only issued 15 penalty fines, I think that's, you know, that's probably good. So at the moment, at least, you know, they're going, as you say, down the education path and trying not to, you know, wield the big stick. But, you know, I think, Grant, inevitably, as time goes on and more of these, you know, small aircraft, remotely piloted drones get up in the air, I think there's probably going to come a time where they're going to have to start waving that stick around and, you know, really start making some examples of people who really just can't help themselves.
Well, hopefully the drones down here aren't like the green laser beams that have been causing havoc around the world, but we'll see what happens.
Yes, we'll see what happens indeed. Well, Grant, what are we at on the time here? About 5.5 minutes. So I think before we wrap up for the year, it's probably time to make an announcement.
Yeah, it is, mate. It is. And yeah, unfortunately, folks, we've decided that due to our day jobs and just life getting in the way, we're going to park the Ausdesk for a while. We may produce the occasional one if the special needs or special issues come up, but at this stage, the regular Ausdesk just, yeah, it's not going to happen, is it, mate?
No, and it's been a tough decision. Now, we've been part of the Airplane Geeks podcast really since about 2009. So what we've really been finding, and is if you're a fan of Plane Crazy Down Under, you'll have no doubt noticed that we've only put out about 3 or 4 shows this year, and with some changes of careers that Grant and I have both had, yeah, it's just getting too difficult, and unfortunately, something is going to have to give. We did give some thought to really, you know, shelving PCDU permanently, but we've decided that we want to try and keep going with that and producing more Australian-focused content for that audience. So, yeah, we'd like to, you know, thank all of you for supporting us and for listening to us over the past 6 years. A huge thanks to Max and to Courtney Miller for all those years ago for taking us on. And, yeah, we've had a great time doing this, probably 300 or 400 versions of this. I don't know. How many have we done, Grant? We've done heaps of them.
Stacks.
Maybe not 400. There hasn't been 400 Airplane Geeks, but we've done probably about 300 Ausdesks, I think. Folks, if you want to go back and listen to archives of that, we actually have a separate website, which is australiadesk.net, and you can go back and listen to most of the segments. I think, Grant, you've put most of them up there.
I've probably got almost half of them up, I think. There's a whole lot that still have to be loaded. including the time that you were away getting repaired with your knee, the Bionic Man series, the sessions when we were trying to fly the balloon across to Oshkosh, and the resulting disasters that came from there. And just as and when time permits, I'll be uploading some of those back issues. But I've got the very first Ozdesks there from back in May 2009 when we were just submitting based as emails. And even from June 2009, which was where the first real Ozdesk episode started, that was just you. And then I came along and, yeah, it's mostly all the current ones, but we've got a couple from the very early days. And as and when time permits over the next 6-12 months, I'll just keep adding some in and, you know, highlight a few of the funnier ones and see what we get.
Absolutely. Of course, we owe a lot to the Airplane Geeks podcast. From there, we started off, developed this segment, of course, and ended up developing it into our own show. And, you know, that's taken us all around Australia. And we've, you know, been doing air show commentary a lot this year as a result of our efforts. And we've done some video production. We've been to the US. We've been to New Zealand. We've been to Malaysia. All over the place, and it all started here at the Airplane Geeks. So we're going to miss making this segment, but we hope that everybody understands why that needs to happen. And yeah, if you'd like to, if you're really, really a masochist and you want to keep listening to us, well, we'll be back in the new year with a whole new series of PCDU.
We'll be making them as and when we can, and seeing what we can get out the door. But yeah, as Steve was saying, the new day jobs. Steve, you're now a depot manager, or as I like to call you, a despot manager. so that's taking its toll on your time. Being elevated to that lofty position with the trains. And yeah, my day job has got me absolutely flat out managing things, basically project manager and working my way up to be account manager for the software that we supply to the Australian Defence Force. So not a lot of free time out of that one, but hey, at least I'm getting to fly around a bit and go have some fun with defence folks.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's sign it off there, mate. Until we speak to you all again at some point in the future, we want to wish you all the very best for Christmas and the new year. And with, as always, we wish you a safe and prosperous one. Until we meet again, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
As always, cheers, folks.
Catch you later.
All right. Well, we really want to thank Steve and Grant, really from the bottoms of our hearts, really, for the effort, for the quality, for the laughs, for the just amazing things that they've contributed to the show for the last, well, I guess, 7 years about. And we really want to thank them.
Ed, I know you were mentioning fairly recently that Australia is among our top three countries worldwide for listeners. So they've played a really big role, I think, in you know, providing something that's tailored to all of our listeners down under. So we really thank them for everything that they've done. And we'll have to find a way to continue to provide our listeners down there with good information on what's going on in aviation down under.
Yeah, and I don't think we've heard the last of Grant and Steve. Of course, planecrazydownunder.com is the way to follow along with their show. But I think that we'll hear from the guys from time to time, and we really look forward to that. Okay, now it's time for Peter Johnson Across the Pond.
They're starting the light. You can see retracting the last little thing. We've got all of England counting down, all of the UK getting ready for launch. Here we go.
Navigation's
lighting.
There are the main boosters.
Here we go. And exactly.
Waiting for liftoff.
You're going to see these fall away as the vehicle starts to pull itself away from
and
Earth.
We have liftoff.
The Tim's away.
Big cheer.
Sound of the BBC and Chris Hatfield at the Science Museum, and that was for the live launch of Tim Peake to the International Space Station. It's been a fantastic week for Britain in space, and so I got on the phone to speak to STEM Ambassador and author for Rocket STEM, Amjad Zardi, about what he thought on this week's events. Amjad, it's been a fantastic week this week. I know you're just about to break up for the holiday break, so thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you're more than welcome. And yes, it has been a fantastic week. Obviously, so much good stuff has happened for Britain, and it's well overdue.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So we saw Tim get launched earlier this week. Fantastic times, fantastic scenes from the Science Museum and around the UK. Where did you watch it? Where did you watch it from?
Sadly, I was actually at home, doubling up, working on my day job, but then also doing this as well, doing a bit of reporting too, but watching this. All my eyes were on the television, but then later on I went down to the Science Museum as well to soak up the atmosphere in the evening.
Right, okay, and we saw some fantastic views, particularly of kids getting really involved and really getting behind this.
Absolutely.
What do you think the Tim Peake effect has had on the UK?
Well, I would say it's geometric, literally, the way it's multiplied. Obviously, it's been a slow burn on with schools to get him up to the speed, but slowly bring the children in to start working on some of the experiments, contributing to Raspberry Pi, but all the other various experiments that are on the website as well. But they know that this is going to continue on. But as of Tuesday, as of launch day, you saw the effect. It just exploded, literally. And I think everyone saw that. Parents, politicians, business leaders all saw the effect that was having, not just on them, but onto the next generation as well. I think it's really made people perk up their ears and sit up straight and pay attention to the space sector.
Yeah. And how do you think, Amjad, you're very involved in your ambassadorial role for STEM subjects? No, you are. You're a shining light to us all. What do you think are the real practical things that we can all do now to capitalize on this and get more, particularly youngsters, coming through the STEM subjects?
Yeah, well, certainly from a practicality point of view is making sure that we capitalize on the work done so far in engaging youngsters in science, technology, engineering, maths, the STEM subjects, obviously. That is a lack that we have had. And we desperately need new engineers to come up through the ranks to bolster our industrial complex and these are our historical strengths. We need another Isambard Kingdom Brunel to be, you know, leading the way, or an army of them, really. That's what I think. So from a practical point of view, businesses should be more involved, obviously. But it starts at home with the parents, engaging youngsters before they even get into school as well, making their curious mind, we're all born with an innate curiosity, but making sure their curious minds are engaged from a very early age and propelling that onwards and supporting that. We do need support, because that fell away after Helen Sharman's mission as well.
Yeah. I've gone out and bought a book on the International Space Station. So,
oh, very good. Was that the Haynes manual?
No, it's for my five-year-old. It's a youngster's book. So I'm very excited about giving her that for Christmas.
That's a classic present, I think. And if you've engaged with her on that, I think it's fantastic. I mean, I bought my nephew's to tie in with the whole Star Wars hoopla, a Death Star planetarium.
Yeah.
So that's going to be in the fictional universe, but then also with a flick of a switch, beam up the whole all of our constellations as well on their bedroom ceiling.
Yeah, exciting stuff. Well, it's been a fantastic week. Thank you very much for taking a few minutes out of your schedule for us.
No problem. Always a pleasure.
Have a fantastic Christmas.
You too. And have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you and obviously all your listeners as well.
But watch as they separate here now. You should see the little flip, flip, flip of the four boosters coming out
of the emergency escape system.
So we're waiting for that.
There they are.
The boosters are going.
The spacecraft.
And they're staging. There they go. Wow. See the solids coming out, or the external boosters coming out.
Is that the cover?
Thanks, Peter.
It's so wonderful to hear all of the cheering and the screaming and the excitement.
The enthusiasm is just, it's great to see it when we talk about the space programs.
Yeah, and I guess we've lost a little bit of that in this country. You know, it became routine for us. I don't know how to say it. When I was listening to this, when Peter said it, all I could think of was how jaded we've become here in the States. You know, we've put a man on the moon and we've got now an astronaut that's been living in space for almost a year. And we forget the joy of what we do. You know, it's we don't. There's a lot of people, countries out there that don't have astronauts, and we have multiple in space. You know, and we as a country here in the United States need to look back and look at all the amazing things that we do and start celebrating it like other countries, like UK is doing with their first astronaut. So it's a good reminder that that there's more to it than just putting somebody in orbit, and that's routine.
I think also that the enthusiasm that we saw in the early manned space flight days and through the Apollo program and so forth, I think that's only just below the surface. And I think that came out with the photographs of Pluto. I think that people really got engaged, and I think we started to see that sort of spark of passion that we've seen in the past. So I think it's there. I don't think it's gone away. It's kind of below the surface. But more things that bring that to the surface and sort of capitalize on that, I think, would be just wonderful to see, and a great aid to the space program, manned or unmanned.
Well, and I'm watching my Twitter feed go off the charts with SpaceX landing their first stage and deploying 11 satellites. So I think we need to get space back in people's faces, and
yes,
they'll start enjoying it again.
Agreed. All right. Well, we have a recording from our friend Micah, our main man, Micah. This is something that he sent us kind of a while ago that we haven't been able to play till now. This is called "Will the Circus Be Unbroken?" And here's a little short piece from Micah.
The race to the bottom continues. It's a tough race, a difficult race, fraught with crazy thoughts, new ideas, tight turns, and deceptions. But it's a lot of fun to watch. In fact, it's great to be a spectator. As of the end of October 2015, we have a new entry, and one that's likely to do well, American Airlines. Yes, my fellow airplane geeks, I may have said this before many years ago, and from a slightly different perspective, but with American Airlines' formal entry into the race, this topic deserves another foray. You see, American Airlines plans to offer a low-fare, no-frills service so it can compete with the low-cost carriers. But why? Well, as a contemporary and competitor of P.T. Barnum, a man named David Hannum once said, "There's a sucker born every minute." He was describing Barnum's attitude toward the public. It seems American Airlines can boast that same attitude in their launch of no-frills service. Frankly, it can be said about any of the low-cost carriers. And please note, low-cost is in quotes here. Why in quotes? Well, low-cost doesn't mean what the public thinks it means. Now, I'm not talking about you, not the regular listeners to this podcast. I'm sure you all know better. I'm talking about maybe the guy next door that wants to take his kids to Disney World in Florida. This guy hears about a low-cost airline with great fares out of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, about an hour drive from here in Portland, Maine. He checks it out and sees he can get a round-trip ticket to Disney World for $145. What a great deal! So he goes to make a reservation. Then he finds out it will cost him an additional $8 to put it on his credit card. Not that there's any other way to pay. They don't take cash or checks. But that's okay. It's a low fare. Adding $8 isn't much more. After that, he sees it's $12 per person if he wants to sit with his family. $2 per soft drink on the plane. And remember, you can't bring along any beverages of your own. It's $25 to check a bag and $18 for a carry-on. That changes a round-trip ticket to $267. But still, $267 total? That's not bad. It's a low-fare airline, after all. So when he gets to Florida, he finds out he's not in Orlando Airport, MCO, but in the Sanford Orlando Airport, SFB, 50 miles away from Disney World. So now it's another 2 hours round trip in a rental car and more travel costs. Remember, this is the guy next door who knows nothing about airlines. He's not in a loop like you and me. He thinks he's getting a deal based on the P.T. Barnum theory of advertising. So he goes ahead and assumes he got a great price on a low-cost airline. Why does he think that? Well, it's Barnum theorem. He was told it's a low-cost carrier, so it must cost less than the others. But he didn't book his trip on a low-cost carrier. He's on a low-value carrier. That's a big difference. It's the same as when we hear, "Buy one, get one free," or "Now at 50% off," or "Half-price sale." Think about it. Those are meaningless statements. The odds are there's no extra value there at all. I never trust a merchant that tries to sell me on how much I'm saving. I want to know the price I'm paying. Then if I want the product, I'll look to find where it costs least. And that cost must include support. Well, support for lack of a better word anyway, but you know what I mean. The true total cost. That's what determines value. Now let's look at that guy next door again. If he would have simply looked at what was available locally, he would have seen that Southwest offers a fare direct from Portland, Maine to MCO Orlando for $273 inclusive. Well, that's direct with a stop and a change of planes in Baltimore. Nonetheless, $273 inclusive. In fact, if this guy doesn't want to check baggage, he can have that same basic fare for any of the airlines flying PWM to MCO. Why would anyone want to drive an hour to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, to travel on a low-value carrier to a place 50 miles distant from their real destination? It bewilders me. But the whole race for the bottom has me confused, too. Why not offer service, advertise value, and demonstrate the ridiculous nature of what low-cost carriers really offer? Southwest has started to do this with their transparency campaign. I don't like the made-up word, but it speaks well for the concept of value. Not that Southwest is perfect. They still charge $12.50 per ticket for early bird check-in if you want to choose your seat or sit with family. Alas, though, my guess, the race for the bottom will continue. American Airlines has joined it, which means the others can't be far behind. Based on what is often cited by some co-hosts here on the Airplane Geeks, United offers some similar low-quality service, but unfortunately, without the reduction in price. It's disheartening. It seems the airline circus continues as carriers hold to the P.T. Barnum attitude toward the public. As for me, though, I'll continue to fly the best value and try to avoid the circus. For the Airplane Geeks in Portland, this is your main man, Micah.
Thanks, Micah.
Sounds like he's all primed and ready to start an airline that offers value.
Oh, maybe this is the start of something that we could call like the main desk or something. No,
exactly. Yeah, that's where the hub will be up in Portland probably.
Yeah. So we always enjoy Micah's pieces. He's we have another one that's in the can, as they say, that we'll play sometime in the near future. And we really hope that we'll hear more from Micah in the coming year because he's always got just great stories to tell.
Can we make a resolution for 2016 that we will not whine and bitch about United? wait a minute. The two people who do that aren't on the show. I'm sorry. Never mind.
We'll have to wait.
Well, I think the three of us could sign the pledge.
All right. I'm good with that.
No new whining.
No new whining.
Well, except for jet whine. I mean, that's allowed.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's do a couple of quick emails from listeners. We can start with Mark. He sent us a video. This is on Vimeo. Warbirds Down Under 2015 DVD promo, and it's what it sounds like. It's a short promotional video from the Warbirds Down Under event that was held. And I tell you, this video, the preview, the promo rather itself is just is really impressive. Some really beautiful aircraft. Some great photography. Mark tells us that that the aviationmuseum.com.au is selling copies, so that's certainly something to look for. We also heard from Ray. Now I get it. This is a CNN piece titled "The Airports Staffed by Animals," and I confused in my head this article with the one we talked about in the news. That's because I was trying to combine the two in my head, and they were actually two different articles, but with some overlap. So this is an interesting article. We'll put a link to this in the show notes. This is the one that talks about the explosive detection mice and the Falcon services and the goats and all that. So we'll put this in the show notes. You guys must have been confused by my confusion.
Yeah, I hadn't scanned down to this part of the show when I had not seen the reference to this. But mice, yeah, so that one still cracks me up. But it says what? Contained inside cages, mice, if one day employed, could sniff passengers and luggage. So I guess they would have the mice there, and as you walk by, the mice would be sniffing away. It still sounds a little odd to me.
Well, why?
Why?
You ever heard of a canary in a coal mine?
Sure.
Well, what different? You're using a mouse to detect something else. I mean,
and so I guess when they detect something, that would be the mouse that roared.
Exactly. There you go. All right. We also got an email from Papa Fox 80. This is another video. This is about a two-place light turboprop.
A Pratt Whitney PT6-powered two-place light attack aircraft that's in the class of a OV-10 or an O-2 in South Africa. It's cool looking.
It
kind of looks derivative. It looks a lot like taking the engines off an OV-10 and making it a pusher airplane like an O-2. But it's a light strike aircraft, and it's being tested in South Africa for use for smaller air forces as an export aircraft. The video is really cool. It's a neat-looking airplane. It's another one of those ones that you wonder if it'll ever go into production, but pretty neat.
I like the part of them towing it down the highway. That looks pretty funny.
Yeah. So thanks for sending that in. Yeah, that is really a nice little video. So we'll have that in the show notes. And then one last item before we close out, I wanted to mention an email we got from Jess. She writes us and says that she wanted to tell us about a new seat leather upcycling program that's been launched by Alaska Airlines and Looped Works. Now, the story here is that Alaska Airlines, like basically any airline, is always upgrading their equipment. And in this case, they have some surplus leather seats. So they want to be kind of environmentally friendly about that. And so Alaska Airlines has worked with this company, Looped Works, in something they call it upcycling, where they take these old seats, the leather seats, and they have created a collection of bags and laptop sleeves and other small
purses,
leather goods.
Purses.
Huh?
Merces.
And so, and the stuff looks pretty good too, at least from the photos. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes, the Looped Works carry-on collection. So you can look for that.
Good Christmas gifts along with Betsy's book.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe you could put book in a, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. So have you guys heard the word upcycle before? I had not seen it used before.
No, that's the first I'd seen that as well.
Yeah, so it says it means a reuse of discarded objects, material in such a way as to create a product or a higher quality or value than the original.
Huh.
Well, yeah, instead of repurposing, it's a more politically correct term.
It's shorter, too.
All right. So, again, link in the show notes for that. So with that, we'll bring this episode to a close. We want to thank our guest, Betsy Case. She's the author of Trailblazers, The Women of the Boeing Company. Highly, highly recommended. Look for links in the show notes where you can find that. All right. Well, let's tell folks where they can find us online. First, David Vanderhoof, we'll start with you.
I can be found on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof and Facebook, if you can spell Vanderhoof. And of course, I guess it'll be coming out this Thursday on the UAV Digest, and I look forward to talking to all of you in 2016.
Great. Max Trescott.
Oh, I can be found with an eggnog, and I'll be sitting next to the television with the U-log burning on it.
Oh, you're so East Coast. You just can't deny it.
It's true. I lived on both coasts for about the same amount of time now, I guess. But I can be found at the usual places, you know, maxtruscott.com or Facebook, Twitter. And if anybody is out here for the holidays in the Silicon Valley or San Francisco and you want to go flying, give me a holler. I'll be happy to pull out the old Cirrus and we'll go for a ride.
Cool. That's a good reason to stop in that area.
Why not?
Yeah. All right. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Also, I'm on LinkedIn. David mentioned at theuavdigest.com. Also at paxexpodcast.com. That's PAXEX for Passenger Experience Podcast.com. You can find us, of course, at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/382. If you'd like to find us on social media, you know, the easiest way is just to go to airplanegeeks.com and look there at the right-hand side, and you'll find links to all the usual social media places. So that's going to do it for this year's Airplane Geeks podcast. Maybe this has been kind of a longish episode, but hopefully it'll tide you over. We look forward to speaking to you all again in 2016. Thanks for a great year. It's really been a great year for all of us, and we hope for you as well. I'll mention that opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next year as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Happy New Year, everybody.